And on this episode of the Reclaiming the Garden podcast, we have a conversation with Miles Markham, who was one of the keynote speakers at QCF this year.
Yeah, as we've kind of mentioned previously, I was able to go in person. April was able to tune in
virtually,
virtually to his keynote, and yeah, absolutely loved it, and was very excited at the prospect of having him on the show. And I'm so glad that this was able to happen.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't ask. You'll notice that Anna's asking most of the questions in this interview because my head has been in paper mode all day. But you know, I still try to be like intently listening.
Listen, we are busy humans, and again, Miles.
Yeah, he was great in terms of sharing his story. Yeah, great. Also, like theological ideas. Like, I think when he mentioned at the very end about joy as like a spiritual discipline, I was like, ooh, maybe the title, we'll see.
Yeah, but no more spoilers. Without further ado, here is the interview. Miles Markham, he, him, or they, them, is a queer and transgender Native Hawaiian Japanese American born and raised in the Deep South. Miles has been working in the LGBTQ+ movement building for the last decade through education, advocacy, documentary film, and direct services, and currently serves as the development manager for Trans Lifeline and volunteers on the board of directors for Transmission Ministry Collective. So, Miles, we are so excited to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I wasn't at QCF in person this year, but I did watch your keynote. Very, very...
It was wonderful. I still have the notes in my journal that I took during it. So, again, definitely resonated with myself and April and a whole bunch of other people. So thank you so much for what you do.
I'm glad to hear that, because my only goal in putting that talk together was that people walk away from it hearing that, all things considered, it's still fun to be gay.
Absolutely, definitely. And again, just the what you brought up in terms of like the importance of friendship, and that friendship in the queer community is so holy and so beautiful, because it's just, yeah, it was just absolutely wonderful, and it definitely allowed me to kind of rethink some of my own relationships in my life. So thank you so much for that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So I guess we'll start off with the question that we start off with every guest. It's nice and lighthearted. Tell us about your faith journey. Where did you start? How have you ended up? Feel free to go into as much detail or as little detail as you'd like.
Nice and lighthearted, huh?
Yep.
I want to live in a world where that's true, where you can ask somebody that question and it... Mm-hmm. And it is a nice and lighthearted response. That is not my story, but
not the story of this interview on the podcast.
But there are touch points of levity, so hopefully that will come across in my sharing. In my bio, you read that I grew up in the Deep South. I have parents who were not from that region. My father was Native Hawaiian, Japanese American, raised on Maui. My mother, Swedish German, raised in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. And when they were thinking about having a family, they wanted to live on a beach. That beach needed to be affordable. They both worked in the hospitality industry for hotel companies, resort companies, and that kind of thing. And so Florida was where my siblings and I were raised. The part of Florida that I grew up in is more culturally Southern, as you might think of that word in all of its expressions, than Central Florida or South Florida. North Florida is a lot more like its border states, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, than it is the rest of the state.
Sure.
And so for me, both my parents, even though they were Christian people in a pretty open-minded and I would say compassionate and even like loving way. The way that faith was sort of held and practiced in the communities we grew up in was a bit more rigid, a bit more focused on, you know, what you might call capital T truth, a bit more interested in preaching the heaven and hell, eternal consequences of it all, than my own parents were interested in emphasizing. And so one way I talk about my faith as a child is to say that in my own household, as a queer and transgender person, I was safe. I had parents who I knew loved me, who I knew were proud of me, who I knew were interested in advocating for me and being able to support me to live like a healthy and happy life. The churches that we were going to were much more invested in, they would say discipling, so I'm going to use that word, discipling people into a very particular kind of Christianity. I was a part of a couple different churches in the small town I grew up in because I loved it. I was like a very spiritual little kid and then became a pretty religious teenager. Okay. And so I was in youth group, both in a United Methodist church as well as a Southern Baptist church. And then in my high school, I was running a Bible study that met before school once a week as well. And any opportunity I could to get involved in city or regional evangelical ministry, I took advantage of. I believed that I was called to ministry, to work as a professional Christian. And I very much looked at what had made me feel different throughout my life, whether that was pertaining to my ethnicity or my race, my gender, or my sexuality, as aspects of my identity that Jesus wanted me to lay down. And in doing that, some might call that assimilation.
Sure.
I was pretty well received in the church. I was consistently given opportunities to lead groups or lead ministries. I shared pretty candidly with people from early on that a part of the cross that I was bearing was related to, at the time I would have called it same-sex attraction and gender confusion. Those are in air quotes.
Sure.
For people listening.
Of course.
and that resulted in one of two really visceral responses from the communities I was a part of. Either I was praised and I was celebrated for being so candid, for being vulnerable, for being honest about the ways in which I was quote unquote broken, but quote unquote surrendering that to God to heal. Or the other end of that was I was repulsive to people. I would see, you know, in their physical responses to me, in their facial expressions, that learning that that was a part of my life was disgusting to them. And
yeah, it's like, even if like you're not acting on it, even if like you're side B celibate, whatever, it's like they're not going to actually ever accept
queer people. And because that's, you know, how homophobia works, right? Like that's how transphobia works, is that if at your core you have this prejudice that causes you to fear in very unconscious ways, that's going to materialize and impact the way that you treat a person. And so I kind of had that dual treatment going on all the way through high school and my undergrad experience as well. Was I was very earnest, you know, in my pursuit of loving God and wanting to serve other people, and was pretty consistently being mistreated by other Christians and being confronted with the various those prejudices and fears that many Christians are taught to have.
Yeah.
About people who look, act, think differently than they do. So what sustained me through all of those years was a real intrigue by this idea of like God as like big and mysterious. I felt consistently very curious about the world and about other people and the various answers that have been put forward around, you know, where do we come from, you know, as humans, and why are we here? Where are we going? Is there any kind of big story or meta narrative to guide us along the way? And even as bad things were happening to me, even as I was experiencing psychological distress and even suffering,
yeah.
At times, I believed that those experiences were not in vain. And I didn't believe that God endorsed them or was behind them. I call it like queer intuition, but I knew at like a guttural level that the way I was being mistreated was separate from the character of God, from how God intended for us to be able to see each other and treat one another. And so I think in that way, that theology, like that particular belief, protected me from some of the more serious ways I could have been harmed or traumatized, because at my core, I think I genuinely believed that God loved me and cared for me and was fighting for my best interest. And because that was true, I was not being motivated by hell, those like eternal destiny kind of incentives were frankly not interesting to me ever. I really never found it interesting, even in like a scary way, to concern myself with eschatology, end times, like the doom pieces of like evangelical Christian theology were such a...
Which like so many are like, yes, they're obsessed, yes, with it. Right.
Right. Well, because they play on fear, right? But I coming to God from like a place of like love and possibility and curiosity.
Yeah.
Those through lines were a very low priority for me in my time in like evangelical Christian ministry. And so I was very moved by Christian philosophy, which gave me space to have big questions and to not be shut down or told to be quiet. I found community among other evangelicals who were very serious about intellectual honesty.
Wow.
And yeah, not a story you often hear.
Yeah.
but it did protect me. It really did, because I had friends and I'd made connections in ministry with other people who were not satisfied by reductive answers to very hard questions. Things like the problem of evil, you know, why suffering? Kind of basic like ontology questions like what does it mean to be, you know, what is in the Christian case to be made like in the image of God? What does that look like? What is sin? I think had this survival instinct to move toward people who were going to be treating those questions with the appropriate nuance that they all deserve. And so in that way, sometimes people ask me like what my orientation to like the ex-evangelical movement or like deconstruction space is, and while I have quite a few resonances with the conversations that happen both online and in person around these topics, one way I've always described my faith journey is that it's almost always been additive, not like detractive, and constructive, not destructive, which is just my own story and it's my own framing, but for me comes from this experience of instead of building up a house of cards in a very high and fragile way, my faith was always a little bit more lower to the ground, and not to say that it wasn't deep, but I had questions from the very beginning, and those questions were allowed to lead to other questions, and my trust was never in the institutional church. My trust was never in a particular stream of Christian theology. My trust was in God as like a possibility. And for me, like even my kind of born again, like baptismal commitments were not me saying yes to the Christian story as a matter of like certain knowledge. It wasn't saying yes to the Christian story as a matter of that like capital T truth. It was me saying yes to letting the God question bother me for the rest of my life. And
That reminds me of in Rachel Hot Evans' Searching for Sunday, like her chapter about confirmation is like, you know, you're not saying that you necessarily like fully believe all this, but you're saying like this is the story you're gonna write.
Yes, exactly. So. And I think a lot of people miss that, especially like when kids like become Christians so young, and you're saying you're making a profession of faith when your brain is still in that like binary, like yes, no, good, bad, like true, untrue space.
Yeah.
It's different. I think faith is different when it's happening in a black and white, when you're being presented black and white information, when your brain is just beginning to do the black and white, like categorization kind of thinking. And that was just not my experience. Like I was very spiritual as a kid. My parents were introducing me to Christian spirituality, but I did not make this like personal profession of faith until I was 14, which is still young.
Yeah.
But it's not like being six in doing that.
Sure. And so many people we know, like, they'll be like, I gave my heart to Jesus at four, and it's like,
yeah,
like I'm sorry, you were just potty trained. Like, yeah, that is a huge commitment to make.
Yeah, you cannot understand the words, yeah, of the sinner's prayer.
Yeah, and like I think our spirituality begins at an early age, but that like religious component, right? Like the statement of faith piece of that feels not something that I think we have to overhaul altogether, but I think having an understanding of that from a more comprehensive, like, biopsychosocial, like, perspective would really benefit the way that, like, we raise kids in faith communities, because I do really value like the rights and like the minds of children to be able to grasp kind of sophisticated concepts in their own way. But I do think it's dangerous to teach, for example, that a child, because of who they are, not because of what they do, is responsible for an ancient murder that had indefinite cosmological consequences on like the human species. So that's something that if I ever have kids, will not be in my parenting. But yeah, I do think that's why, that's at least part of the why I have really leaned into more constructive theology, liberation theologies, and a little bit away from deconstruction theology. Not that that isn't valuable or extremely healing, I think, for a lot of folks, but it just did not need to be, it has not been like a salient part of my journey because, my faith has, it's been like a story of continual expansion and not restriction.
Absolutely. I'm curious, like, would you be able, because again, we call ourselves a deconstruction podcast, but also like everyone's definition of that is different. Everyone's at different points of their journey in figuring out what they believe or what they don't believe. So I'm curious to know like what your definition of like the difference between like the theologies that you are more exploring versus like deconstruction theology.
Yeah, I mean, so much of this is colloquial, sure. And I do think that people, we use words because they're helpful. We use words because,
Yeah, I mean, the word deconstruction as well, it's partly, like, from the philosophy of Derrida, and then it's also, like, a metaphor people think about, like, a house being, you know, sort of taken apart.
Yes. Yeah, and so I think, for me, the biggest distinction would be that the house metaphor, right? Like my house, like of Christian spirituality, was not built in such a way where it had to be leveled in order to become like healthier and life-giving. I would say like the bones of the house, always had integrity, were always pointing, toward human flourishing. And the bones of the house, you know, the foundation was set in such a way that, renovations like had to be made, but it was not like we have to implode this thing sort of scenario, which I think is true for a lot of folks who grow up in more conservative expressions of evangelical Pentecostal.
Yeah, for me, like everything just sort of crumbled before my eyes.
And that is not uncommon.
You mentioned like, you know, you didn't believe that God endorsed your suffering. Like I unfortunately like was definitely like, when I was having depression in my first semester of college, I was like, why is this happening to me, God? Because I believe that God was the cause somehow. And now I think back and I'm like, wow, that's fucked up.
So for me, I was not formally introduced to liberation theology or all of the other expressions that have kind of come out of that tradition and trajectory until before seminary. It's what like made me interested in seminary. So probably around the time I was like 24 or 25 when I was reading Gutierrez and James Cone and learning about like Mujerista theology, Asian feminist theology, womanist theology, like that came to me at like 25 years old. But Sort of one of the hallmarks, like, of the liberation tradition is this idea of God's preferential treatment toward the poor, right? And the poor sort of writ large. Those who have been disenfranchised, marginalized, not just people living in poverty, but yes, people living in poverty, but those who have been rendered poor. By the state, by society. And even though I didn't have the language for that until 25, I felt that as a child. I believed that God did have priorities. And the priorities were for people who are being hurt and harmed and are suffering and being mistreated. And I think that set me up to have, like, that more firm foundation, you know, in like a healthy Christian spirituality, because it meant that things like abuse, injustice, hatred, structural violence and oppression, all of those things, I believe, like, God stood against and was inviting us into taking that same stand.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been, for the paper I'm writing for my Christology class on the death of Jesus, I've been very deep into James Cone, Sean Copeland, Dolores Williams, so yeah, I'm, like, writing about that sort of thing in my paper as well. Like, one way of interpreting Christ on the cross is, like, God's solidarity with the suffering and oppressed.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So I think even without you know, the formal or, like, academic, like, approach, like, to those theologies, I felt that in my body throughout, like, my journey.
Definitely. And it's very interesting, as you bring up, again, the suffering and the poor, like, especially by the state, is one thing that a lot of people will say is, like, you know, why does God allow bad things to happen to good people? And then the easy peasy answer that a lot of Christians will give is, it's because of free will. And it's like,
sure.
In a way, like, here's the thing, is in a deeper sense, yes, there are people who are impoverished and suffering because of the choices that people in government and people in power have made. But obviously that is too... Yeah, exactly.
It's because of greed.
The choice to be greedy, like, the choice to hoard resources and hoard wealth. Sure, they had the free will to do that. But again, like, I think a lot of times, it is so much, especially in the United States, such an individualist country, it's so much more put on the individual and the bootstraps and that whole sort of bullshit, rather than looking at the collective and looking at the system.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know. I think it's really interesting to me because, I have countless friends who are in this, they might describe themselves as, like, post-Christian or post-evangelical sort of space. And in their minds, that means, like, ipso facto, they are now an atheist. And that is never something I experienced, just because I recognized there were more categories than simply theist, atheist.
Sure.
And all of the different ways, like, agnosticism could, like, be represented. And for me, like, agnosticism is really much more about, like, epistemic humility than it is, like, not picking a position.
I think my sister joked once, she's like, don't call me an atheist like that. Don't associate me with, like, Richard Dawkins,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Is the first she said.
Right. Well, and that's, like, new atheism, sure. Which I would say is, like, the more, like, pedantic, popular level, but poorly represented, like, less sophisticated case, like, for atheism in the world. I don't like it either. But... I don't know. That is just not my experience. And something I ask these friends is like, well, like, did you ever take any time to explore the, like, thousands of other ways that, like, people are Christian in the world? The history and hidden, you know, but nevertheless existent track record for Christians, like, standing, like, for justice, like, for equality, yeah. for inclusion. Because even if those stories have been buried, they do exist. And I am not interested in defending Christianity. I am not interested in apologetics or trying to make a case for, like, why people who once called themselves Christian should still call themselves Christian. But I'm very curious about for those whom leave, like, a very conservative, harmful, even toxic, like, stream of, like, Christian belief and practice, and then go to nothing, versus those who leave and find something much more nurturing, you know, for them, yeah. that gives them the tools to really be able to heal instead of remain, I think, in a kind of traumatized state around what they experienced in more conservative, and I'm talking largely about, like, queer and trans people, but there are others too who are harmed by, like, those theologies and those types of churches and Christian institutions.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And it's that thing of, like, sure, there is a lot of trauma and people come back and go back and figure out things for themselves in their own time. But again, there's so much more to be able to explore. In a way, it almost kind of does disservice to the person who may want to learn something more and not realize they have other options.
Right. Yeah. And that, like, it's so interesting. I worked for,
when I realized, like, how many Christian denominations there were, I was like, oh, and we thought we had everything right.
Like, yeah. I mean, I talk about, to my partner, grew up in very conservative religious contexts. Most of those were Southern Baptist, but she regularly would use the term Baptist to describe it and assume that when people hear Baptist, they all think the same things. And my response was like, well, actually, like, when you say Baptist, there's at least, like, 8 very distinct streams of, like, Baptist faith just in the United States alone.
Right.
And they range, like, from extremely conservative to extremely progressive. And so even just using, like, that term Baptist, like, you're talking about millions of people who believe quite differently across, like, the theological spectrum. And I think I always knew that. That's also something that was, like, a protective force for me, was that religious diversity and even just denominational diversity was never an occasion for insecurity or fear in my faith. I actually just thought it made, like, the picture of God, like, more interesting and beautiful. And I think what I was about to share was that for 7 years, like, I worked exclusively in Christian education, providing, like, LGBTQ Christians tools and resources designed to change the minds and hearts of non-affirming Christians. A lot of apologetics, a lot of appealing to the ways that more conservative Christians discern, like, truth. And over the years, what became very important to me to do with these different groups and to do in these different webinars and workshops was to zoom out and do more teaching around epistemology, to do more teaching around what it means to know anything, and like what this,
yeah, because I mean, I think that like in these conversations sometimes, particularly if you're like talking, trying to like sort of argue like about the clobber passages or whatever, often evangelicals are coming to it with a very different view of the Bible than you might have. Like for me, I don't necessarily think the Bible needs to like match, quote unquote, like match our lives in a sense. And so the way that I think about the clobber passages is like probably not the way that they, like an evangelical who's like tries to take things more literally would take it. So that's, yeah, your thing about epistemology.
Yeah, maybe think about and that. I think like if having curiosity was not a part of your spiritual formation, that becomes like a lifeline for you in carving out a healthier spirituality later in life, is what does it mean to be curious, just like about yourself, about other people? Because I think it's so easy when you've experienced religious trauma and abuse to just move, like to keep the same style of thinking, but just to move from like a conservative theology to like a liberal or progressive theology, instead of moving to like true open-mindedness.
Yeah.
It's like folks move from one form of closed-mindedness to like another form of closed-mindedness. And in both experiences, I just feel like they're perpetuating anxiety. They're perpetuating prejudice. They're perpetuating a kind of sense of like urgency, emergency. I say it's like driving an ambulance, like a theology where you're driving an ambulance all the time. And what I want for myself and for the people I love and communities I've been a part of is a spirituality where like we're not in an ambulance anymore. I don't know what like an alternative metaphor is, but it's one where questions don't stress us out. They are, it's a spirituality where mystery is fun, it's interesting, and suffering is not framed as like a consequence of our personal, individual, like sinfulness, but the like cumulative result, you know, of living in a world that is not the one we want it to be.
Exactly.
Whatever the cause, it's not the world we want it to be. And so I don't like, I think Christian mysticism has also been a place I've found a lot of solace. It's kind of guided my journey, just that sort of orientation to spirituality, being drawn like to the unknown or even like the not knowable, it's been great for me. Because I feel like it just turns down the volume on the conversation and lets you think and gives you space to be and to try and to learn and to have a growth mindset. You don't have to believe perfectly.
Exactly.
You can figure things out.
I know. Getting
as you go.
I mean, like, with the exception of seminary, getting an A in religion is not something that necessarily people should be striving to do, because it is so different for everybody.
Right. Right.
Now, one thing you had mentioned as well is kind of like that, what is it, like the, where it's like kind of two sides of like the horseshoe or like the bell or whatever, where it's like, one thing I've noticed is a lot of times there is kind of those two sides of, you have like the people who believe in rapture theology and like, especially with like the eclipse that just happened and like the world is ending any day and nothing matters because Jesus is coming back. But then you also have the other side where it's almost like a nihilism of, there's no point to anything, nothing matters. Why bother? Why try? And I
think it's important to be able to recognize going from one extreme to another, even if the reasoning behind said extreme has changed, and finding that balance and finding that wholeness and as close to the middle as possible. Obviously, we have our biases and whatnot, but being able to find that wholeness.
Yeah, I think it's something I've experienced over the years in conversation, you know, with folks who've are sort of on this similar journey, whatever we want to call it.
Sure.
Constructive, deconstructive.
Transformation.
Yes. I encourage people to ask themselves, like, what does it mean for me, like, to feel safe? For me to know, like, in my body, I'm going to be okay. And I'm going to be taken care of. And being able to name, like, what that looks like is not something I feel like many people in their, like, Christian journey have been invited to ask themselves.
Yeah.
I think you're often being told, like, this is what's going to make you safe. This is what's going to make you secure. This is what's going to keep you in, like, good standing with God and, like, with other people and, like, with yourself. Like, and all of that is centered around avoiding sin. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, for those of us who grew up, were born and grew up from, like, the 1980s forward, I would say, like, 40% of, like, evangelical energy is, like, dedicated toward not having sex. And so if you believe that your both, like, eternal and your, like, present safety, like, health and wellness is connected to not having sex as, like, the, like, penultimate.
Right, because if you have sex before you're married, then your sex when you're married is going to, like, suck.
There's all of these different, you know, kinds of tropes and misinformation that's given out around that. But I just think that you don't actually give people the tools in that kind of teaching to discern for themselves what is safe. You know, what is nurturance? Like, what does it mean for me to feel loved, for me to feel cared about, for me to imagine myself, like, as a priority, you know, to the people in my life? And I think if we were encouraging in faith communities people to ask themselves those questions and to share about our own journey and being able to answer those, it changes, like, what kind of spiritual community you have, because all of a sudden you know, the focus around discipleship is not so much about not having sex. It's about so many other things. Christian life gets to be bigger and more holistic and more grounded, you know, in your day-to-day realities.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important thing to be able to remember and hold on to as well. But yeah, we are actually almost at time for wrapping up. So before we let you go for today, any final thoughts? And how can people find you? How can people best support you and the work that you do?
Sure. Final thoughts. I think that something back to, like, those questions of, like, safety and healthy and, like, what it means for you to, like, feel good in your body. I also encourage folks who are participating in these kinds of deconstruction conversations to think about joy and to think about delight and to imagine that that is a spiritual discipline to move toward both of those things. So that's my closing reflection, is to reframe. You know, we're taught like that happiness is bad, happiness is sinful, happiness is selfish, and I just...
We should want holiness, not happiness, even though it's like, actually holiness is enjoyable.
Yes, like, that reframe, I think, is so critical, and so ask yourself that, you know, what do you delight in? What makes you smile and remind you of, like, the hope and the possibility in the world, and how can you move toward those things? Mm-hmm. And in terms of finding me, I will say I'm not particularly prolific on the internet. I do have an Instagram, but it's not like I'm a public person having an Instagram. It's like this is my life. These are my family and my friends, and so my captions mm-hmm. are going to read like inside jokes or esoteric, because they are. It is just my life. I am not reflecting publicly on my Instagram, but it is you can find it. I'm not private. It's a million miles, so a_million_miles with a Y. And where else am I? I get like Instagram. I'm 33, so Instagram is. I'm still on Facebook too. You can find me on Facebook. And you can also. You mentioned I work at Trans Lifeline. My email, my work email, there is miles@translifeline.org. So let me know if you want to chat. Happy to discuss further any of these things. I do have some writing online. I have a website, milesmarkham.com.
Yes. We'll put that in the
show notes. And I do have some essays. They're more theological reflection, has been posted there. So you can find that on my website.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that. We'll definitely have those in the show notes for people to follow and read and find and that whole sort of thing. But otherwise, thank you so much for being on the show. We're so grateful that you were able to join us.
Yeah.
Okay, hi the week.
All right. Well, it has been a month since we uploaded, I believe. Yeah. So, boy, oh boy, a lot's happened in a month. I would say like my most recent highlight was I got to see Flamey Grant in concert.
Ooh, I get to see her next week.
Yes. Yeah, so she was playing at Jess's church. So it was really cool to see her in such a small venue in like a church setting.
Yeah, mine's going to be at a relatively small church setting as well. So
yeah, I love it. She's doing like a church. She's doing a church tour. It's kind of cool. But yeah, I took my partner with me, and we both very much enjoyed it. And I was able to get a vinyl of her album, which I desperately wanted to buy in Albuquerque, but I was terrified of traveling with it and specifically putting it into luggage. So now it is going to be on display on our wall. So yeah, was very glad to see Flamey Grant. What is your high of the week / high of the month?
Well, I don't know how much I've actually shared about my creative writing workshop on the podcast, but the last time we recorded it was, I think we had set the date and location and everything, but now the curriculum's mostly complete. First session, going to talk about what it means to be made in the image of God. I'm going to give an analysis of Genesis. With the help of Austin Hartke, like in the book Transforming, not literally with
still, but that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean figuratively, like using his work. And then sort of translating that idea to creative writing, like how do we what is our voice and how do we like cultivate it. I'm still figuring out what the creative writing prompt for that session is going to be. And then I have a session that I'm super proud of called The Body as Storyteller, where we look to the body as a space to start telling our stories. And like, we sort of deconstruct the cultural narratives we've been told about our bodies and tell our bodies a new story. The prompt's going to be writing a letter to your body. Yeah, those are first two sessions, and I'm very excited for them. It's going to be 5 sessions total. I need to still finish some of the curriculum, but it's fine. It's exciting.
That's incredible. That's still very exciting, and I'm so glad that you've been able to put on these amazing workshops and healing for other people. So that's very exciting.
Okay, the next guest. It's a guest that Anna invited, and I've only seen the name typed out, so you're going to have to pronounce it.
Yeah, so our next guest is going to be Mish Van Essen. She works for Transmission Ministry, and I had the opportunity to meet her at conference this year, and I'm very, very excited to be able to bring her on the show so we can have a conversation together.
Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of Reclaiming the Garden. You can follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Reclaiming the Garden, or on Twitter at RT Garden Podcast. Be sure to check out our Patreon for exclusive episodes, and you can always check out our merch store to get t-shirts, mugs, and other fun merchandise. If you are able to, please be sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as it does boost us in the algorithm. But we are grateful that you are here and listening, so if that's all you can do, we appreciate you. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you soon.